up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Well, good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty along with my co-host and friend Maria Hall. And we're going to have another good show for you today. I promise you that if you stay tuned. Maria, let our listeners know what they're in store for.
All right. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, loud and clear.
All right. Well, in our first segment, we'll speak with Amy Gray Schlink, a representative from the Freedom Socialist Party, an alternative political party in the United States that aims to serve a feminist and anti-capitalist constituency. Then, in our second segment, we'll get an update on the escalating ICE enforcement in California, as well as the legal challenges, political opposition, and public outrage that are slowing down Trump's agenda. We'll speak with immigration attorney Maria Zavaleta on those issues.
All right. I'm looking forward to it. I know one of the guests only through reputation, and so I think it's going to be a great show, and I do encourage people to stay with us. Let's get right started on our first topic of the day, which has to do with, it's the fact that it's no secret that capitalists run this country. And they've been very effective, of course, in preventing other political parties, other than the two capitalist parties, that is, from having any real power or much traction in the United States. Well, the Greens have made some progress in getting on the ballot in a number of states and won a few seats here and there. Here in California, the Peace and Freedom Party has gotten and stayed on the ballot for years now, and some socialist candidates often will seek its endorsement. But candidates who are not Republican or Democratic Party members rarely win seats in Congress or in state legislative races, and when they do, it is noteworthy because of the rarity of such alternative candidates winning elections. So from time to time, I like to invite representatives of anti-capitalist parties to come on our show and talk about what their party stands for, how they conduct their political work, their role that they play in progressive coalitions and in electoral politics. So today I'm going to be talking with, as is Maria, an official from the Freedom Socialist Party, which has branches in a number of cities around this country, including right here in Los Angeles. The Freedom Socialist Party is a feminist socialist party, and of course, it is decidedly anti-capitalist. Our guest, who will educate us about the Freedom Socialist Party, or the FSP as it's referred to for short, is Amy Gray Schlink, the FSP's educational coordinator of the party's California Bay Area branch. She is a queer parent and works as a plumber at the San Francisco Water Department. And she's a member of the United Association of Plumbers and Pipe Fitters and of the group Strength in Numbers. Well, Amy Gray Schlink, a warm, warm welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Wow. Thank you so much. Warm indeed. We really appreciate this chance to have this discussion.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We'll get to the details in a minute, but what is your very short answer to this question? In broad strokes, who and what is the Freedom Socialist Party?
Okay, a very short answer to broad strokes. That's not fair. No, we are a multiracial, multigenerational, multigender party, and we're working to build a revolutionary movement to replace capitalism with socialism.
And you are that covers what I wanted very much, Maria. You're next up, asking our guests the questions.
All right. Well, I'm interested in what made you decide to call it a feminist working class party. What's the reason for the emphasis on that feminist philosophy?
Great. Well, as a matter of fact, the Freedom Socialist Party came out of a split in the Socialist Workers Party back in the 60s at the height of the civil rights movement and at the budding of the feminist movement. And we actually split over those two questions. Women leaders, women activists, women revolutionaries were often shunted to the back of left organizations and progressive organizations, just like every organization in a sexist society. And Likewise on the race question, we wanted to really be, outwardly anti-racist and looking at the fact that you have to defeat racism, you've got to be anti-capitalist. But what it came down to also was just that when, when you look around, a revolutionary movement isn't inclusive if it's not feminist. You've got to be looking at, who's the most oppressed and who has the best view of what needs to change. And for us, I'm really happy that our foremothers and forefathers, looked and realized that, if you have the view of what needs to change, you're going to be in the leadership and moving and shaking. You've got nothing to lose. So your leadership is going to be the most militant. And that's been the case for, women, especially women of color, queer women, trans women. And so the inclusivity is really important. And also just the, as we've gone on over the decades, just realizing that in every movement, it's not the old saying maybe was, that women were, we couldn't do it without the women, but a lot of times that meant, serving the meals or, typing the speeches or whatever the case may be. But we're saying women's experience is to basically, working class and poor women's experience is to basically always be ready to fight and, to try to get other people to come along with that. So the feminism is really born of a sense of under a, under capitalism, under any system that's, got a pecking order for the genders, however many genders there are. If there's a pecking order, the people on the bottom are going to be, willing to fight and, fight for what they've got coming. And then we also know that women are generally the ones that do also look out for the kids and the elders and in communities. And so women are going to have an inclusive vision even beyond just their own.
Well, and I would say too that certainly this was not so true in the civil rights movement. I mean, sexism in the earlier days kept the women who were doing so much work in these movements often out of leadership positions. But
You
by the time
bet.
of the anti-Vietnam War movement, even, but certainly when you go beyond that and you get into the immigrant rights movement, you get into the movement today on behalf of Palestine, women are in leadership roles.
Yes.
And doing, frankly, more of those movements, I think, as a gender than our men. Well, in your newspaper, Amy, you make a point of saying, under the heading "What We Stand For," that the SFP is the answer to, quote unquote, "to rule by the 1%." The answer to rule by the 1%. Is it your contention that, by definition, rule by either the two capitalist parties guarantees undemocratic rule, or rule by a government comprised of billionaire bosses and take advantage of the working class Americans? Is that the point of that?
That's our contention for sure. To elaborate on it, I would say, kind of when we're kids and in school, we learn that, the government is in charge of everything. But we can see, especially in these desperate times, the economic system and the people that run it are really in charge, and the government is there to basically do their bidding. And so under capitalism, I mean, it's scientifically looking at it, it's an unstable kind of a system, and it's dog eat dog, and capitalists don't even take care of other capitalists, so it's an exploitive system, and there's got to be an underclass, and the underclass happens to be huge. The 1% is very small, that ruling class, and the rest of us, are exploited, are having our tax money, going to things that are not our priorities, and we don't get paid enough at work. And just to keep these little tiny reforms that we've fought for, whether that's abortion or anything else, just to keep them, it's a fight. And sometimes we still lose them, obviously. So, the 1% is there to do one specific thing, and that is to, to keep the profits rolling in. And, again, by definition, you got to make more this quarter than you made last quarter. So, I mean, it's a desperately fierce and, frankly, violent system that's, willing to and does, in fact, scrape and claw to get those profits. And so what we contend is that, socialism is about a fair distribution of the world's resources, and it really turns, it is the opposite of capitalism, and represents completely different priorities. And it's a system that could actually be run democratically. It's a system that, working people are smart enough, and the world's majority is smart enough to be able to figure out, how many, whether it's how many sweet potatoes we need to grow in a community, or where the schools should be. Working people are we've got our hands on the keyboards and on the shovels and the we're doing all the work, and we see the sometimes we think, oh, that's crazy, that doesn't make any sense, these decisions that are made by our bosses and managers and government. It's not crazy, it's just that they're not our priorities. And so we really do think that, number one, get rule away from the 1% and put it into the hands of the people that create the wealth, and that's the 99%. And again, that's, the working class, poor people, employed or not, but the working class, and the ones that are really here to, all we can do under this system is sell our labor.
Well, Amy, let's take a look at your party's 10-point program.
Okay.
The first point on the list is called, quote, "No more bailouts for bankers and speculators." Why is that number one? Why is that so important?
Yes. Well, I mean, again, it's tied to what we were just talking about. I mean, it gets back to, again, who runs the show. And it's, again, it's not the government. It is really the bankers and the mega profiteers and these speculators. It's, however you want to say it, big business or the big bourgeoisie. I mean, there's millions of ways to say it, but it's the ruling class. And, again, it's kind of, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. If you're a big banker or a speculator, and you want to, just take advantage of this dog eat dog system and try to make all your profits and, just be doing terrible things to people that need to take out loans. I mean, I didn't even realize, I just realized today that I just opened a savings account that I thought was a free savings account, and I'm still paying $5, a month. Like, they're squeezing all this money from wherever they can, and they've got employees that they're exploiting too, all these bankers and so forth. So if you want to live that way, you sure as heck don't deserve, you're more than happy when it's working for you and when you can, basically exploit to your own benefit. So number one, it's just no fair. Why should you be bailed out if you're willing to, do that to humanity? Well, then you're gonna have to take your chances when it fails. But it's also about, all these bailouts. I mean, whether it's the 2008, crisis or any other bailout that's taken place, that's our money. I mean, working people pay a vastly higher, proportion of the little bit of money that we have to taxes. Corporate taxes just keep going down and down and down, and there's loophole after loophole. So, it's almost like it's unfair, two and threefold to then give money back to these poor little Chase, and Bank of America, these poor little, rich kids. It's just totally not the priorities of the vast majority of society. So, bailing them out, it just, I mean, it does. It just feels like such a, it's more than a slap in our face. I mean, people are dying. People are suffering so much, and to just imagine that they should be able to turn around and say, well, that was no fair for us. We need to be bailed out. It's again, it's two and threefold unfair.
Amy, another one of your 10 points calls for raising the workers' standard of living. Again, the Democrats are quick to say that they too, of course, want to raise the standard of living. Republicans mouth similar kinds of things. Both of them, of course, when they're running for office, at least. How does what the FSP is calling for differ really from what the position is of the Democratic Party or either of the capitalist parties?
Sure. It differs quite a bit. I mean, as you said, I mean, the Democrats, they will say that, but I haven't really seen them, fighting for it. I haven't seen them enacting any, real genuine or even proposing any genuine legislation that's going to seriously improve the lot of the majority of us, or especially, improve the lot of the most, the lowest income folks. So They do like to say that, but they don't get specific. And they also, are the first ones to say, well, we couldn't strike a deal. We couldn't strike a deal. And that's the thing about being a socialist. We're not trying to strike a deal between two powerhouse capitalist parties. I don't care what they can agree on. I don't care what compromises they can come from. We've got to totally, look outside of that box and expand our understanding of what the political landscape is. I mean, if the Democrats are the left, I don't know, what that makes socialists or even just the average working person, So there's much more to the political landscape than that. And so what we're talking about is whenever we talk about it, we're talking about a living wage. And, obviously that is going to depend on, Los Angeles or San Francisco or New York or, different places have different opportunities. They have different, costs of living. But regardless, we're talking about let's achieve that by having public works programs. Let's stop contracting out. I work for the San Francisco Water Department, and, so much of our work is contracted out to, literally to companies that are run by friends of management all the way up, to the mayor's office. So
Wow.
let's stop contracting that stuff out. Let's create more public jobs that are union jobs that also give us protection in the workplace and an actual ability to, fight together, which is a lot easier in a union than without one. And then, we'll figure out the number that the actual wage needs to be, but the standard of living is a wage. It's benefits. It's having housing. It's having, a place where my kids can be after school until I can pick them up. We're even talking about we don't need to be working 40 hours a week. We could do everything that needs to be done in society. Let's do 30 hours for 40 hours pay. But even that, we don't need to be even be working that much. So when we talk about a standard of living, we want to turn the whole question of, well, what would be a living wage or what should the minimum wage be? That's such a small slice of our entire, the whole way of surviving in the society. So we want to talk about the whole, every aspect that would make, again, your question, the standard of living, so much higher. And it wouldn't be that hard to do if we just didn't have people, hoarding and hoarding and hoarding the world's resources. And then again, back to the privatization question, why does PG&E have say over they burn, our landscapes, they burn people's homes down. They're pretty terrible to their employees. I mean, PG&E is bad on so many levels, and yet their rates go up and up and up, and they get to call the shots, and they seem to have, the California Public Utilities Commission in their back, in their front pocket, whatever you want to say. So, the privatization question too is a huge part of that. If we didn't have all these, resources and services privatized, it would be already a whole lot, it could be easily a whole lot better for all of us.
Well, Amy, before we leave the topic of standard of living for workers, I wanted to follow up on that for a moment. The Democrats are quick to say that they too want to raise the quote unquote standard of living. So, how does what the FSP is calling for differ from the position of the Democratic Party?
I mean, I guess I would say, that again, they just don't, they're not really calling for anything, and they don't get specific. And once in a while, they float a number of a, an hourly wage that everyone should have. And sometimes, there are places that have accomplished a higher wage than, say, the federal minimum wage, but it's just such lip service, and I think what they just don't do is really offer a vision of what that could be, because I don't think they are willing to actually fight for it. It's not that's a it's a false it's a false premise that that's a priority. I mean, they may talk about things a little bit more and differently than the Republican Party as far as, trying to sound like they're with the people. But again, if you're just comparing the Democrats to the Republicans, it's a pretty narrow slice of the political, aspirations of people. So I think the difference is just really that we want to get in there and say, there's everyone is entitled to a job. Everyone should, all jobs should be organized and unionized. And, along with that, in every city, in every state, in every community, we need to have free childcare. We need to have, we can talk about meals programs. We can talk about community kitchens, but and those are just some ideas. Obviously, the whole community's got to weigh in on what's needed the most, but that's what the Democrats are not going to do, is go and talk to whole communities and say, what do you need? They're gonna put something out and hope nobody challenges any more broadly than what they're putting out. And that's just a, again, that's kind of on its head. We want to be, we're working people in the Freedom Socialist Party, so we're going to talk to our neighbors, and we're going to see, what would really make a difference to, improve our standard of living.
Yeah, and the working class, the white working class certainly, has caught on to the false hope that the Democratic Party has got an answer for them, because they've turned away from voting for it out of desperation, vote for the Republicans, who of course are no better. Amy, it's no secret that it is virtually impossible at present for an openly socialist party such as the Freedom Socialist Party to get on enough state ballots or to win enough seats in either state legislatures or for the US Congress to govern in America. And when parties like yours ask for voters to vote for their candidates when election time comes up, people often respond, "Oh, but that's just throwing away my vote, Jim. I mean, hell, I'd rather see Harris in the White House than Trump. Okay, I'm not that excited about her, but gee, she's not Trump." How do you respond to that lesser evil argument? And the related question, how does a revolutionary party like yours hope to ever overcome the many hurdles that are in your way to eventually having state power?
Well, I think, again, it goes back to just looking. I mean, it's interesting. A lot of what we've talked about so far is, about the Democrats, but I think that's exactly what we need to be talking about is, as you said, some people have already realized that the Democrats are just not going to do what we need them to do. But I think, just recognizing that putting your vote, putting a working class vote, putting a transgender vote, putting the vote of a mom who's working two, three jobs, automatically to the Democrats, it doesn't pull them to us. It pushes them to the right. And the landscape over the last several decades has just been moving to the right, to the right, to the right. And if you're gonna give them the vote, it kind of says, well, I didn't have to really work that hard, because what we were just saying, they don't propose legislation that's really going to improve our lives, and they don't really fight the Republicans, and it's always just throwing their hands up. And even I felt like Cory Booker's recent filibuster, that was theatrics, that wasn't leadership, that wasn't really making a play to say, okay, at some point the Democrats, we've got to do something for working people that's really going to impact their lives. It's theatrics. And so when I look at how the political landscape keeps moving to the right, it tells me that a protest vote, ideally for a socialist or for an anti-capitalist candidate, in the FSP, we don't always run candidates, but we have run candidates from community college, to all the way up to 2012. We ran a presidential campaign, we've run for governor. But we've got to either run ourselves or support other anti-capitalist candidates to show, that's how you show the Democrats and the Republicans, frankly, that we're tired of it. We're not, you don't get our vote by, by being the lesser of two evils, and we're not sure how much less evil you are even, so protest campaigns like that, I think, are really important. And then the other thing is, we do need something besides those two. I think you said in the intro, there's alternative parties that try, but what we need to have is like a grassroots labor party effort that really is, independent of the Democrats, it's independent of corporate influence, and it gets the unions involved, it gets rank and file union fighters involved, and it gets people that don't have anything to do with unions but are clearly working class folks. And if we can, it's not a small effort, but if we can take all this, all that the Democrats take for granted. If we can, if you go door knocking, if you make phone calls, if you make donations, if we put all that into something that the 99% is in charge of and that's run democratically, we've got to have, a way to run it democratically. And I believe that we can have those safeguards. That's a whole different ball game. So, working for a Labor Party right now is really something that we want to popularize. We want to talk about. Again, it's for everybody to weigh in on exactly what it's going to look like. But the Freedom Socialist Party wants to be part of that effort. And, we'll win some of the fights in there and we won't win some of the fights, but we want to get working people making the decisions. Let's get working people setting the priorities. And I mean, in terms of how we can ever overcome those hurdles, it's not going to come through the ballot box, that's for sure. And I never say that meaning that elections aren't important, because we see, the right to vote constantly under threat, and in fact being actively taken away, and people have, fought and died for the right. And elections are very important, but there's something we can use to educate. If we could, if we could actually build a Labor Party, there's something that we could actually use to mount some power. But ultimately, it's a movement. It's a movement that needs to build and build and build, in the streets, to really say this whole system's got to go. It's not about reforming it, and it's not about, finding one good mayor or governor or president. The whole system's got to go because the priorities are just completely completely screwed. And I think skewed, excuse me, I didn't mean to say skewed. And I do think that as we're trying right now to mount, a genuine effort against creeping fascism, which is creeping faster and faster. I mean, creeping is starting not to be the right word. It may as well be a revolutionary movement to replace capitalism altogether.
All right.
Well, Amy Gray Schlink, what final comments would you like to leave us with? And how do our listeners learn more about the positions and the work of the Freedom Socialist Party?
Well, please do check us out. Please check out socialism.com. That's our website. And I would love to say, I'd encourage everybody to check out our newspaper, the Freedom Socialist newspaper. It's really a grassroots effort at covering news from around the world. So check that out. And if we're in a city near you, please come in person or Zoom into one of our meetings. And if not, write to us, email us anyway, because there's ways that we can work together no matter where you are. So we want to know what you're doing, and we want to let you know what we're doing.
Well, Amy Gray Schlink, we certainly thank you for letting us know what you're doing today very eloquently, and what the FSP is doing, the Freedom Socialist Party is doing. So we thank you again, and we wish you every good luck in the future.
So much appreciated. We'll look forward to continued collaboration. Thank you so much for the work you're both doing. Thank you for your show.
Thank you. All right. Well, and I guess we can take our station ID a minute or two early here. The world will come to an end, I hope. And then we'll be right back with you with our second topic of the day, friends.
You're listening to KPFA 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara County, and across the globe at kpfk.org. Pacifica Radio for all the servants, California and beyond.
Well, and we are back with you. That was a very quick idea for the station break. You're listening, of course, to KPFK 90.7 FM here on your dial. And you're listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. And I'm Jim Lafferty. And along with Maria Hall, we co-host these shows each week at the same time. Maria, let's get to our second topic of the day. And why don't you introduce that topic and our guest, please?
Great, will do. Well, as you know, Jim, it's been 5 months now since Trump returned to the White House. As expected, immigration enforcement and anti-immigrant rhetoric has intensified across the country. It started on January 20th, of course, when Trump signed an executive order that revived and expanded some of the most hardline immigration policies of his first term. That executive order is ominously titled, "Protecting the American People Against Invasion." It increases the authority of ICE, encourages deportations, denies funding to sanctuary jurisdictions, restricts access to public benefits, and reduces legal immigration as well. Since then, other political and policy debates are playing out, such as renewed attacks on people who have lived here legally for years and even decades under temporary protected status, who are suddenly facing forced removal. But these policies are not sailing through unopposed. No. Legal challenges, political opposition, and economic realities are slowing the administration's progress. And immigration lawyers are on the front lines, including our next guest, Maria Zavaleta. Maria is passionate about defending the rights of immigrants with experience in family-based, humanitarian, and naturalization matters. Born in El Salvador, she came to the U.S. as a child with her mother, seeking a better life. Maria worked as a community organizer before pursuing a career in law, and today serves in leadership roles with the American Immigration Lawyers Association, also known as AILA, Northern California Chapter, and the Alameda County Bar Association, and volunteers with the National TPS Alliance. Maria Zavaleta, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you, Jim, for having me today.
So we are sharing the mic today. So Jim, you'll have to let us know if you can hear us both clearly.
Loud and clear.
Okay. So first question, Maria. Trump campaigned on a promise that he would focus on deporting the most hardened criminals 5 months into his term. Tell us, who is actually being targeted and threatened by the administration, and who's being most harmed as a result?
Thank you, Maria, for that question. Well, in my opinion, everyone who is not a citizen is being targeted. And we're talking about lawful permanent residents when they attend citizenship interviews, TPS holders, Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans with parole, international students and scholars as their visas are revoked, artists from abroad pursuing employment visas, and of course, asylum seekers. Even immigration judges, we saw rapid firings and reassignments of judges and key personnel in the immigration courts earlier this year. And Trump's, you know, immigration policies, they center around mass deportation threats. And of course, this is affecting families and communities across the country.
Mm-hmm. You know, just in the past week, we've seen headlines about ICE raids and arrests at courthouses. This was in San Diego. And also, though, in the Bay Area as well. Why is this so unusual? And why are so many advocates and lawmakers outraged and calling for it to stop?
Well, Jim, as we know, due process is the cornerstone of our system of democracy. And if you leave your country of origin because you fear return, you have the right to seek asylum. And many asylum seekers must prove their case in immigration court. Some are either represented by counsel, many are not. And so in immigration court, people have to attend master calendar hearings and ultimately something that's called an individual hearing, which is the equivalent to trial because the immigration judge issues their final decision at that hearing. If any of these hearings is missed throughout the process, the judge will issue a removal order because of that failure to appear. It's called an in absentia removal order. But the government, they've stated that arrests at courthouses, they're safe for law enforcement because people have gone through security and they have been verified as unarmed. Mm-hmm. So this puts people in a difficult place. If they don't go to court because of that fear that ICE may arrest them, they'll be ordered removed in absentia. And it just further puts them in danger because now there'll be a removal order. But if they show up and the government attorney seeks dismissal of the proceedings and the judge grants that dismissal, they walk out effectively undocumented out of that courtroom and ICE will be at the courthouse ready to arrest them. So, you know, part of the problem is also the judges that are granting these motions to dismiss and not allowing respondents time to oppose the motion or get counsel, not informing unrepresented people of the repercussions of the dismissal. And, you know, the government is actually using what's called boilerplate motions because they're arguing, quote unquote, changed circumstances, but they're not actually addressing the case specific changes. And so this is really creating an issue with due process and people's right to seek asylum in court.
So in other words, it sounds like with laying in wait outside courthouses, people are generally in a lose-lose situation. So what do we know about the people who have been arrested by ICE at courthouses? For example, what kind of court hearings were they attended? You mentioned a couple. And what might be the consequences for missing their court dates? Can you expand a little bit more on that?
Yeah, so the majority of the people that we have seen that have been detained have lived in the United States for less than 2 years, or they were initially apprehended near the border and subsequently released by ICE during that same time frame. And so the government's goal is to place them in what's called expedited removal proceedings, which is a much faster process than the standard immigration proceedings. You know, I've seen cases of people who have been in that standard immigration proceedings for 10 plus years. Expedited removal obviously is much faster, but it puts people in a much difficult place if they, you know, they don't have the time to get counsel or, you know, find someone willing to represent them in those proceedings. And we're also seeing that they're targeting people of all ages. There has been accounts of kids getting detained as young as 2 years old. And so the types of proceedings, like I mentioned, the majority of people are seeking asylum. Again, these are folks who are afraid to return to their home country due to persecution. And they're following the legal pathway that our country has said they have to take in order to seek relief. You know, so it's important for people to know, though, that if they are placed in expedited removal proceedings and they articulate that fear of return, they have to be given something called a credible fear interview. Excuse me. So if they attend that, if they are given that credible fear interview, they pass, then they have to be placed in the standard removal proceedings process to seek asylum again. So back to square one. So for whoever might say, or, you know, expedited removal is more effective and a better use of the government's resources, if clearly people have a fear of return and they pass that credible fear interview, they have to then be placed back in the standard track of immigration proceedings. So consequences of missing a court hearing, as I mentioned, is that an in absentia order or a removal order will be issued because of that absence. And that's something that ICE can then execute at any time.
You know, immigration law and policy, of course, like other areas of the law, I suppose, is filled with acronyms. One of the, in particular, that's been making the headlines is TPS. Can you tell us what is TPS and why is it in the news so much lately? And why is it so important for listeners to understand what TPS is all about?
Yeah, Jim. So TPS stands for Temporary Protected Status. It's a humanitarian form of relief granted to individuals who can't return to their countries of origin due to war or other disaster. TPS is an issue, like Maria explained in the beginning in my introduction, that hits home for me because as an immigrant from El Salvador, I have family under TPS. Under the first Trump administration, TPS was under attack. And the only reason why families were maintained together was because of litigation that carried on for years. TPS designations are granted for 6, 12, or 18 months, depending on the government's discretion. So every 6, 12, or 18 months, when the period is set to expire, the government has to reevaluate if they'll terminate TPS or extend. And Trump has terminated TPS in the past, and they are threatening to, you know, terminate TPS again. Most recently in the news has been the reversal of the designation of TPS for Venezuelans, and the Supreme Court has allowed them to move forward with those terminations. So, you know, this is obviously going to affect families like mine and other TPS families that, you know, are here work lawfully under TPS with a work permit, because the moment they don't have that lawful status, obviously they, and if they don't have any other avenue for relief, then they'll be placed in removal proceedings.
Well, you know, one of the things, Jim, that we mentioned at the top of the segment was the kind of the economic realities as well that are putting some stumbling blocks into Trump achieving his agenda on immigration.
Yes.
I just wanted to note the LA Times had a kind of a funny article yesterday about the sanctuary jurisdictions. They had 500 listed that they were, you know, threatening to take funding away from. But it had so many errors in it that they actually depublished the list. And in fact, they had on it, I encourage listeners to take a look at the article. They had on the list of a sanctuary jurisdiction, Huntington Beach, which is kind of hilarious because they were the all Republican council who voted specifically to be a non-sanctuary city. And they're suing the state of California for being a sanctuary state. So, and that was the only city in Orange County. Not listed was Santa Ana, which has been called themselves a sanctuary city since 2016. So I think we can see just the chaos and the kind of absurdity of what they're trying to do. So it's great that this leads me into the next question, because it leads me into, you know, they're really trying to stoke fear among advocates, among immigrants, among anyone who speaks out against this administration. So for Maria, I wanted to ask you, what are some of the challenges that immigration lawyers are currently facing in this current political climate? I heard that the administration even sent out these, you know, letters saying that immigration lawyers should self-deport when they were citizens. So is that a mistake? Is it they trying to just scare people? And tell us how immigration advocates are staying strong.
Yeah, Maria, well, you know, as you said, it's a culture of fear, and they're very much trying to intimidate people. And certainly challenges are the budget cuts to organizations that represent unaccompanied children. You know, obviously, we're talking kids who likely don't have funds to pay a private attorney. And so, you know, organizations that represent unaccompanied children are doing great work that's very much needed. And when budgets are cut, then there's less people that they can employ to represent those kids. Then there's also the immigration lawyers ourselves being attacked by this administration, creating fear, making people, obviously we work hard for our licenses and you know, like it's like some people potentially could be bullied out of doing good work, you know? And then the constant uncertainty with the policy changes. Oftentimes those policy changes come on Friday afternoons. And I mean, there's even strategy to that, right? Constantly making everybody be on their toes. So I think part of how people in this field are staying strong and personally, I mean, staying informed, being in community with other advocates, spending time with my family. You know, I mentioned my family is personally affected by you know, any termination that would come of TPS for El Salvador. And so obviously things are different now than they were back in when it first happened. I'm an attorney now and, you know, but things are still just as impactful. And, you know, being more intentional about self-care, whatever that means for you. For me, it means, you know, exercising and trying to not look at my phone past a certain time. But because every single day, you know, it feels like you're getting attacked from all, whether it's immigration, the environment, there's always something. Mm-hmm. So I think definitely staying in community and being more intentional about your time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fear is within the community, of course, itself. And in fact, you have immigrants who are self-deporting, don't you now, which I think is very sad. One of the questions that comes up, and I've been rather impressed with, there have been places, and I can't think of a particular city off the top of my head at the moment. I know it goes on here in LA, but I mean, beyond that, where citizens who are not involved personally in this question of whether they're facing deportation or not, find out when there is an ICE raid going on, or maybe they stumble across an ICE raid going on, and they shout out to those being gathered up and arrested. Don't say anything. You don't have to answer questions. You wait. We'll try to find you a lawyer. And yet, of course, undue interfering with a ICE officer in the course of exercising their duty can get you into a lot of trouble too. But isn't it the case that there are a lot of brave people out there really standing up to ICE, and they're often thug-like tactics when they go about trying to apprehend people?
Yes, Jim. I mean, even just this week, I have friends and family in Minneapolis, and there was a raid at a restaurant, Mexican restaurant on Lake Street, and obviously people showed up to try to stop it. And a friend of mine took a video of another friend of mine being pinned to the ground and picked up and thrown because even though as a US citizen, she was trying to like make people aware of their rights and was hurt in the process. And so I think there's a lot of for US citizens who are trying to help when things like ICE raid happens, there's a lot of bravery that has to go into that because they're putting their own bodies at risks, So I agree that there's a lot of attacks on people at the moment.
Let me ask you a follow-up question, if I like, because when you were saying something a moment ago, it came to me. Despite the fact that when Trump was running for office, he made it very clear what his plans were around immigrants. Now, he talked in terms of criminal immigrants, but he also just talked in general about, hordes of Mexicans coming over the border who were rapists and thugs. He talked in general to a to his base about getting rid of immigrants. He talked he was going to, have 10 or 12 million immigrants deported from the United States who were here without landed status. And yet, despite that fact, despite his clear enmity towards his clear enmity towards immigrants, and nevertheless, we know that more immigrants voted for him this time than last time. How do you account for that? How do you account for that?
Well, yes, I think it was extremely disappointing to find out about the mass amount of Latino men that voted for Trump
Yeah, especially the Latino man, you're right.
in the last election. I think, I remember when I found that out feeling, when I talk about being in community, I felt like it was a little bit more difficult in the beginning to be in community, knowing that some of my community members voted for Trump. And I think that, as an immigrant, and we have mixed status families, and there's some family members who forget where they came from, who forget that they were also immigrants or come from, another country, and unfortunately put their business ahead of human rights or whatever it may be. And in a personal level, in my opinion, I feel like that's disheartening. And I've had conversations with family members who voted for Trump, and I invite them to come to court with me and see what their, vote is doing. But I can't say why society voted this way because I feel like everybody had their reasons. It's just, very disheartening. And it makes it hard for me at least to feel like I can trust everyone, regardless of whether they're Latino. It's a difficult conversation. So that's why in the topic of like self-care, I think keeping close those that are supporting you and your clients is very important.
Yes.
So Maria, for listeners who may be worried for themselves or their family members, what are some general safety measures that community members can take? Especially, we talked about expedited removal. I think that is people who are not haven't been here for 2 years are especially vulnerable. But as people go about their daily lives, work, school, other activities, the grocery store, church, their temples of their places of worship. And of course, as a disclaimer, this is not legal advice. This is just some general information that Maria Zavaleta is giving us from her expertise as being an immigration lawyer and advocate.
Yeah, well, definitely, know your rights. Workshops are important for community members to attend. The ILRC has the red cards available online that people can either order or print at home, or I know that there's a lot of community members that have printed them. And
if they explain what they are?
Yes. So the red cards have folks, you can print at home and use, and in the event that an ICE officer is knocking at your door, you can slide it under your door through the window, and it has your constitutional rights. They say, do not open the door if an immigration agent is knocking at the door. Do not answer any questions from an immigration agent. If they try to talk to you, you have the right to remain silent. Do not sign anything without first speaking to a lawyer. So, et cetera. It explains people's constitutional rights. And then in the other side of the card, they say, I do not wish to speak with you, answer your questions, or sign or hand you any documents based on my Fifth Amendment rights. So I think that a lot of the ICE officers are very familiar with these red cards, and so it's very good for community to have them at hand. But also having a family preparedness plan, especially if you have minor children. You know, I know it's like it's a tough conversation to have with family, and oftentimes, you know, people avoid these topics because it sometimes families, they don't want to think about these possibilities of, you know, an ICE arrest happening. But it's important to have a preparedness plan, especially if, like I said, you have a minor child, keeping updated, for example, the contact information of the individual that can take your kid out of school if you're not able to pick up your child. Again, the ILRC has a great resource for free on their website that can help families prepare in the event of an ICE arrest. And definitely seek legal consultation, whether it be with a private lawyer or a nonprofit. If there's anything about your circumstances that you want to talk to someone about that worries you, even if you're a lawful permanent resident, because I think people have to remember that if you have a green card, it doesn't end there. You're still deportable until you become a citizen. And so, you know, everyone should seek legal consultation. Your circumstances may have changed. There might be other options for you and your family.
Can you give out the information where this, of how one contacts those organizations you were mentioning, what their website is, or information that would help our listeners who might need what you're talking about right now, a red card or a family member, they want to learn more about how to prepare their family.
Yeah, so the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, or ILRC, their website is, I believe, ILRC.org. I think there's also great resources in the National Lawyer Skills website. Mm-hmm. And as far as local nonprofits in the area, you know, Chigla, Carecen LA, you know, they have their individual websites, but I believe that the Bar Association will also connect you with nonprofits or low bono attorneys. And if you're a student, I would suggest you investigate with your college campus to see if they have a Dream Center or a social worker that can further connect you to legal resources.
And just because we are running out of time, but we do have, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes, I guess, perhaps left. Thinking back again against the election and how it turned out with respect to Trump, and on this question of immigration and his desire to get rid of, I mean, on the one hand, he says, I'm really going after the ones who are criminals, which of course is not exactly what has happened at all. But in the next press saying, I want to get rid of 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country, you know. I mean, is there any other way to look at that except clearly racist? At the same time, he's taking in white refugees from South Africa, for God's sakes.
Yeah, I don't personally believe there's any other way to look at it other than racism. You know, like it's he's choosing the right immigrants that he believes should be allowed into this country versus who he thinks is not. You know, and I think it's based on racism. And you know, in his view, I think, you know, when he's talking about criminals, I think, you know, it's an excuse. He means everyone.
And also, though, just following up on the same idea, this notion that he's going to get rid of this notion that somehow this group of 12 million or more undocumented immigrants are heavily laden with criminals. I mean, that's statistically not true, isn't it?
Yes, I don't have the clear numbers, but it sounds impossible to, you know, be able to prove that every single one of those persons are, you know, have criminal history. Like even the majority of the people who are being detained in the immigration proceedings, you know, there's been, they don't have any criminal issues.
Right.
It's just random because they've been in the U.S. for less than 2 years.
And that's why they're big. That's right. Yeah. Well, in fact, there, I can't give the exact statistic, but I mean, it's well known, frankly,
yeah,
that percentage wise among those of us who are citizens, so let's call that column A. And then column B is those who are not citizens, but living in this country. The percentage of those of us who are legal citizens who commit crimes is considerably higher than the percentage of undocumented immigrants who are here who commit crimes. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to have, if crime was your number one issue in the country, you'd want to get rid of the citizens, and not the immigrants. You'd have a less crime-filled country, frankly.
Yeah.
So that's all nonsense, again.
And
so again, how do people, again, you mentioned with the resource center, that's just, is that ILRC.org?
Yes, ILRC.org. And just one more point, Jim, when you mentioned about, you know, when we're talking about TPS and DACA, for example, they have to be vetted every single time, every 6, 12, or 18 months for TPS when they reapply.
Uh-huh.
They're vetted. They can't have any type of criminal history. So, you know, yes, it's definitely, I agree with your point.
Well, and the other thing that I've been wondering, and I don't know if you know the answer to this or not, and it's not your domain to necessarily know the answer to this, but one of the things that was talked about during the campaigns was, if we really become as strident as Trump wants us to be, won't there be a lot of strawberries that aren't picked? Won't there be a lot of hospital beds that won't be changed? Aren't there a lot of lawns that won't be cut? Aren't there a lot of shortages of nurses and doctors and others? You take a city like Los Angeles, which is now a little over half non-Anglo like me. Is that not the case, in fact, that this is a country that runs to a large extent in terms of many of its important services and products that it produces on undocumented immigrants coming here to work?
And I agree with your point, but I also would say, and people here with lawful status.
Yes.
If you are seeking asylum and you have authorization to work as your case is pending, or if you have TPS and you have lawful work authorization, or you have DACA and you have lawful work authorization, you know, there's going to be a lot of different industries that are going to be, you know, needing labor, whether it's not just, you know, obviously, yes, like there's going to be a very heavy need of people that do farm work. But it's not just that. It's also, we're talking in the legal field, we're talking medical field, we're also talking, I don't know, aviation. I feel like immigrants make this country run, and we're in all sectors of the society, and we contribute to this economy, even through obviously taxes, you know.
Oh, so, good point. Yeah. Right. Well, taxes, and to which you don't always qualify for the benefits for if you're not a landed immigrant in the same thing. And right? I hear where the music is playing again, so that's our signal. We have to just say, Maria Zavaleta, thank you. Thank you for your work and for joining us here today on the Lawyers Guild Show. And friends, until next week at the same time, we'll be back with you then, of course. You stay healthy, you stay active, and you keep standing up for your rights.
Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is on the deer.
Bicycle, come make we ride bicycle, 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 way up we ride bicycle.
Support for KPFK comes in part from Ciclavia, an LA-based 501c3 nonprofit organization who are hosting an upcoming open streets event on Sunday, June 22nd from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Ciclavia Historic South Central meets Watts will transform 6.4 miles of car-free open streets connecting Historic South Central, Florence, Firestone, and Watts into a public park for the day. The event will provide open space for walking, jogging, biking, skating, or simply spectating, all at your own pace. It's not a race, so you can enter and exit the route at any point. KPFK will have a booth along the route, so you're invited to join us on Sunday, June 22nd, starting at 9 a.m. Ciclavia events welcome people of